Welcome to a bonus episode of Tulsa Talks, presented by Tulsa Regional Chamber. I'm your host, Tim Landis. On May 18th, Scott Ellsworth published The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. That American city is Tulsa, which is Ellsworth's hometown. In 1982, he published Death in the Promised Land, which brought the story of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre to national attention for the first time in six decades. It became the most stolen book at the library, which is also where Ellsworth first saw the original newspaper stories through microfilm as a middle schooler in the late 60s. In his book, Ellsworth recounts his nearly five decades of research and work that includes helping the Tulsa Race Riot Commission, which he co-authored the report in 2001. A couple of years ago, he received a call from Tulsa Deputy Mayor Amy Brown asking for his help in the mass grave search. Last fall at Oaklawn, they found 12 bodies that could be from the massacre. They will start the excavation process on June 1st. I interviewed the historian about his new book on May 11th through Zoom, while he was back at his office at the University of Michigan. There was so much great content that I couldn't share it all in print, so by the end of our conversation, I asked if I could share the audio as this bonus episode. We cover a lot of topics in our conversation. We discuss how the book came to be, what it's been like building a story mostly out of oral histories, and what work there is still to be done. Have you heard the stories about pilots dropping bombs on Greenwood? Ellsworth shares insight into what he believes was most likely tossed from planes during the tragic event. He shares his thoughts on whether there should be a criminal trial, the need for reparations, which he says is better described as restitution, and what we're supposed to do after commemorating the centennial to ensure the story continues to be told. He also shares what parts of the history mystery he's still working to solve. Okay, let's get to it. Here is my conversation with Scott Ellsworth about his phenomenal new book, The Groundbreaking. By the time you get to college, this becomes like a project that you're working on.
Yeah.
Did you ever imagine then that this would become a 50-year work for you? Like life's
no,
work?
No, I mean, I couldn't. I mean, you know, when you're 21, you can't imagine 6 months from now, much less anything else. No, not at all. No, and that's been astonishing to me that, I mean, that Death in a Promised Land has been in print for 39 years. I mean, that just kind of blows my mind. No, I didn't think that at all. If you got us, I'll tell you a quick story. You know, I had not planned on writing The Groundbreaking. So, and I'll give you a 2 minute story. It'll be worth it just for fun.
Oh, yeah.
So when I was in the seventh grade in 1967 until 66, 67 at Wright Junior High in Brookside, one of my Lee School classmates and Little League teammates got murdered at a party. And his family had broken up. The mother had two older boys. They were getting in trouble. His name is Jackie Gresham. And he snuck out one night to go to a party. And a pedophile was at the party and tried to sexually attack him. Jackie fought back and the guy killed him. And this is in 1967. I mean, I don't even think the Tulsa World had the word rape in the newspaper. I mean, you didn't talk about, you know, certainly pedophilia, sexual abuse. And what was astonishing, you know, it made a huge impact on me and my other teammates and pals. But what was astonishing is that our parents decided we're just going to tell them the truth and we're not going to try to sugarcoat anything. So they told us exactly what happened. And I'd always been haunted by Jackie's death. And my plan around 2018 was I'd finished the Himalayas book. I wanted to look for a new book. And I'd kind of worked with my agent. I thought maybe I'll write a book about kind of how 60s culture kind of crashed upon conservative middle America. And I thought maybe there was something there and I didn't know what it was. And so I started coming back to Tulsa. I started spending a lot of time at police headquarters going through, you know, the records they had, interviews, all that stuff. And it was in early 2019, the deputy mayor reached out to me about the grave investigation. And that's what I describe. And it just went on. And my agent said, you know, on a Friday said, you know, maybe you could write a book where you talk about both looking into Jackie's death and then your work for the graves. And I thought, well, that's kind of a weird idea, but he's a smart guy. I'll think about it. By Saturday night, I realized if I don't tell this story about the cover up and the uncovering, because I'm one of the few guys still around who knows all of it, it's just not going to get told. And so, I mean, the book proposal came together in about 48 hours. I mean, it just bam, just happened like that. So that's an aside, but I wanted to give you some background.
No, yeah, that's great. So you published Death in the Promised Land in 82, and then there's kind of a jump in time to the Oklahoma City bombing in 95. Yeah. And that kind of kicks things back up again with Don Ross and everything.
Absolutely.
So after 82 and you published the book, did you think then that your race massacre work was over? Or did it linger? Because there is it's over a decade gap where you don't
have no, I mean, I would, you know, people would call, you know, there was a woman who lived in a big fancy house at 18th and Peoria and had a lot of money. And she decided she wanted to make a film about the, what we call the riot in those days. And so she got like a bunch of us to come and give her advice, but nothing ever happened, but there'd be little things would start to open up. You know, I'd hear about stuff. I mean, I tell about how the book was the most stolen book in the city county library system, you know, stuff like that. So little things would happen, but no, I didn't. I didn't think there was going to be. I didn't foresee any particular future for it. I mean, I thought I would probably be involved in what stuff would happen, but I didn't see. I certainly didn't foresee what happened after 95. You know,
it's kind of been an interesting thing because you did that. You had that little over a decade gap, and then you work on the commission and help write that report and everything, and then there's another
20-year gap. Yeah,
right, even longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you get your mind back into that game? Because you were obviously working on other things.
Oh, sure. You know, I think that I think part of it had to do with, at least for the work on Death in a Promised Land, you know, when you're a, you know, I bet, Tim, you remember those first stories you wrote for journalism. Yeah. And because you just sweat blood over them. And you really have to fight just to get the words on the page and stuff like that. So I knew I had, at least I knew my version of the story. I was, you know, I certainly, I'm also blessed with a pretty good memory. And I just knew it. So it took a while, but then you'd learn, you know, in the riot commission days, we learned a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of new stuff. And I'm still learning stuff now, you know, but it took a beat. You know, you had to get back into it and remember where everything was and kind of remember how things go. But I think a lot of it is just kind of seared into my memory. You know, you can take Civil War buffs and they, you know, they, it might be 10 years between one time they go to Gettysburg and another 10 years when they go back there, but they can remember everything. So, you know, I think it's the passion that helps the memory.
Is it fair to call this book sort of your odyssey in Tulsa? Because it spans a long time. You have a wide cast of characters. You're trying to overcome a lot of challenges along the way and dealing with a lot of different people. And there's villains, there's good guys. I mean, I know it's a little tired maybe, but is it fair to call it that?
Well, I think in part, I mean, here was the issue. And my editor and agent both were like, look, don't write about yourself. I mean, they were like, you know, this is not going to be the Scott Ellsworth story. And I as best as I could, I didn't. I mean, you really don't learn anything about my folks. You don't really learn anything about, there's the episode in the lamp shop, but that was because I wanted to give a taste of the tenor of the times in my little greater Maple Ridge neighborhood and stuff like that. But the problem was I kept being at all these places.
Right.
And we had to see them through my eyes a bit, but but it really isn't about me. I don't think so, but I play a role in this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't imagine this book without you being in it when you are, I mean, from the very beginning, when you're with Noe Rodriguez in the cane.
It'd be kind of hard to write that scene otherwise.
And it was such a great scene. I mean, because I'm reading this, and like I said, I know Noe. I've written about him. And so when I read that,
Oh, God, I'd love to see that. He's a great guy.
Yeah, yeah. So when I read that, I was like, oh, wow, here we go. You know, we're jumping in, and we're talking about a homeless camp. And then it shows kind of the whole scope of this, you know, with where the mass graves are possibly located now and everything. Speaking of the mass graves, what was that process like for you to be called back in to work on?
I was thrilled. You know, when we got shut down the first time back in 2000 or whatever year it was, you know, and I packed up all my boxes and I said, someday somebody's going to want to know about this stuff. I mean, I wasn't going to throw it away anyway, but I was very careful in organizing everything. And I just didn't know whether I was going to be on the same side of the grass when that happened. So I'd heard little rumors before Amy Brown reached out, and I thought that's positive. And I thought they'll probably reach out. And I was thrilled and honored. And I felt that this is something important for the city to do and for our town to have happen. So I was really honored to do it and happy to give in any way I could.
After all these decades of working on this project on and off and publishing these books and the report, are you surprised at all to see the amount of attention that is on Tulsa and the race massacre as we near the 100th commemoration?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I mean, when you think about all those days when we're just trying to get the story out, trying to find the records, all that. Absolutely. There's no question about it. There's no question in my mind at all that Watchmen has just had a gigantic impact. And I mean, I heard from people in England, you know, who've seen it. This is Watchmen is a way that particularly young people, lots and lots and lots of young people have learned at it from them. But I mean, it's almost like, you know, at a certain point it's gained a momentum, you know, and things begat other things, you know, after the 75th anniversary, you know, and all of that attention, I mean, that sort of created a cottage industry of books about the massacre. I mean, they, you know, there were like a dozen or something that were written, all different kinds. And certainly there's plenty that are happening right now. But yes, no, I'm really quite surprised at the degree of attention that's happening right now.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think there is so much attention? We've got LeBron James producing a documentary, yeah. Russell Westbrook producing a documentary.
Well, I think there are different reasons. You know, with LeBron and Russell, I think they're interested in American history, African American history, and they saw this as an important story they wanted to go. But I also think that, you know, with the murder of George Floyd, with these other killings, with this awareness of all of that nationwide, you know, as I think that's played a role in all this. You know, in the book I talk about that we're in this age of reevaluation, who our heroes are and all of that. And again, you know, the other thing, you know, but the thing that's been the constant this entire time for 45 years has been people will hear about this and say, well, why haven't I heard about this before? I mean, they are still just amazed at this event. And you know, and the more the word goes, that is going to help build interest.
Yeah.
What do you think? I'm just sort of curious.
About?
Why are you impressed with the amount of attention?
I am. You know, and I documented all of the protests that happened in Tulsa last year, like every night, every day I was there. And so I started seeing the film crews and at the mass grave search and then Reverend Turner on the corner, I wrote a feature on him and spent a lot of time with him over the last year.
I read that. I cited it in the notes, I think. But anyway.
Oh, that's awesome. But yeah, I mean, I am surprised by the amount of coverage that's happening with it. And, you know, I'm anticipating there being a mammoth amount of media here come the end of the month.
Oh, yeah. And then it's going to, obviously, then everybody will leave. But the, you know, I mean, 2 weeks ago, let's see. Last week, I was in town with NBC Nightly News. 2 weeks before that, it was with CBS. Today, I've spoken to the New York Times, to the Today Show. I'm coming back to Tulsa next week and meeting a crew here. I mean, there's just tons and, you know, The Guardian. I mean, all this stuff. There's just a lot going on, you know. And there'll be a huge splash of stuff. And then, you know, the news cycle is going to move on again. But what will be interesting to see, you know, the massacre has still not really made it into history books. I mean, that really hasn't quite happened. Academic historians, you know, they don't, you know, Jill Lepore wrote a recent history of the U.S. It didn't make it. you know, it, but it's, you know, that stuff is coming along, I would say.
Yeah, it wasn't even mentioned in cast. Isabel Wilkerson's book.
Like,
It might have been. It might have been one sentence. But I mean, but to for her, to her point though, the Tulsa Race Massacre was one of many. You know, and on top of that, and with the lynchings, it's like if you did a full rundown of all of them,
for sure,
a lot of space. So I
can sure, but it's just that that the scope of what happened here is beyond what happened anywhere else. Absolutely.
What was it like for you having to navigate all of, because it's almost an oral history. I mean, it's really all we have of it. And so
A lot of stuff that didn't, but anyway,
We do. That's been buried, hidden, trashed, cut out of papers. So we relied on oral history. And so when you're navigating things like witness accounts and such, what was that like for you? I mean, like the planes bombing the buildings, that's kind of a contentious.
So, topic. Yeah, well, and I'll talk about that too. So it's always, you know, a letter in an archive is no more believable or unbelievable than an older person telling you a story. So you always have to vet things. You have to think, is this a reasonable account? Is this a reasonable piece of evidence of what happened? Is this person telling a story that is consistent? You know, how do they talk about other things? And you just kind of have to go like a jury, you know, a historian's a jury in a way to do it. So like the issue of the planes, that was something that I was always, I always had questions about. I mean, there's plenty of evidence in Mary Parrish's Events of the Tulsa Disaster about African-Americans talking about seeing airplanes. There's no question in my mind that there are airplanes there, but there was always a question about, did any drop anything or not? We know they weren't strafing people, all that stuff. And, you know, there was this idea of turpentine balls. Nobody's ever been able to figure out what the heck that even means. I mean, turpentine's a liquid, of course. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, there's a possibility here, but and we ended up in the Riot Commission report figuring out how many planes were in Tulsa and all that stuff. These are all, you know, open cockpit for the most part, biplanes. You know, the air is rushing by at 150 miles an hour, whatever. So the idea that somebody's going to light a Molotov cocktail and throw it out of a plane is ridiculous. They'd set themselves and the plane on fire. So I was always, I bet something happened, but I'm never sure. But then 20 years ago, we talked to this gentleman who had a very specific memory of going to a barbershop in the 1950s, like in 1957, on the white north side of Tulsa. He knew exactly the name of the barbershop, where he went, what he was doing at that time. He's waiting in this shop, and we verified that the shop was there and all that stuff. And there was an elderly white man getting his hair cut, and he told a story about how on the morning of the massacre, he was a flyer and one other flyer, maybe they were, you know, World War I vets, gone and commandeered a plane and that he dropped dynamite onto Greenwood. And what I liked about that story were two things, is that, first of all, aside from Mary Parrish's book, which of only like 100 were made, and nobody in White Tulsa ever saw that, there had been nothing in print about any bombings in 1957. So either this guy actually did it or he made it up full cloth. And then, you know, by then you had waterproof, we studied this, waterproof fuses for dynamite. So you could take a stick of dynamite, it's like these, you know, rednecks in Mississippi, take a stick of dynamite, throw it in the middle of a bayou and boom, it goes off. Because it's not, you know, so I could see somebody lighting it with a cigar or something in his lap and tossing it out of a plane. And it wasn't going to go out. So that made sense to me. I thought it was also very powerful that you had evidence from the Black community and from the white community that agreed that that went on. So that for me was the clincher that, yeah, I could see that happening. But Greenwood was not destroyed from the air. It was destroyed on the ground.
Continuing on that thread, the other, you know, kind of oral history that's being spread down are the graves,
yeah,
where they're located. There are multiple locations. They're the floating down the river. We went out south with Cavan to the cemetery out there that's hidden in the woods by the housing development. Yeah. But there are all those things. So how do you navigate those things? I mean, especially when you hear people talk about how the graves were where 75 is now at Oaklawn. You know, those type of things.
Well, you know, you have to have, you know, especially in terms of our ground penetrating radar work and now our excavation, all that, you know, I always said we needed at least two pieces of independent evidence, two pieces of substantial independent evidence that pointed us to a certain spot. So you couldn't just say, oh, my great granddad told me there, blah, 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 blah. You had to be able to link it to a real person, a real event, or a real set of records, you know, whatever it is. So like in Oaklawn, there had been this rich oral tradition that massacre victims were buried there, but it was vague. And Clyde Snow told us, of course, that you can bury in a 10-foot by 10-foot square hole, you can bury 100 people. So you need to really have a specific place. But then our big breakthrough, as you know, in Oaklawn was Dick Warner finding those old funeral home ledgers that proved that there were unidentified and identified massacre victims buried there. But it still didn't tell us where. And then we had this account from the sextons of the cemetery handed down year after year saying that they were buried in this one area where there weren't any graves in the black part of the cemetery. We also had this set of crepe myrtles that a sexton had planted as a memorial. And then we ran into ground radar, and the ground radar said, oh my God, if this isn't a mass grave, I've never seen one. So that seemed pretty good. And what happened? We did that in July, is nothing. Instead, we found a bunch of 30s landfill. But we knew that there were at least 18 African-Americans buried by white funeral home people in Oaklawn. And then Betsy Warner kind of cracked the code on how the sextons buried people in the Potter's Field. And we got lucky, you know, and we found it. But, you know, you have to have more than one piece of evidence. I mean, it's a long time now, you know, and the technology isn't that good. It's not like on CSI where you point this thing and see a skull. It's not like that at all. So we don't really quite have the technology that's good enough. So you just have to use common sense and just try to extrapolate as much as you can from the oral evidence and other written evidence too.
In the groundbreaking, you share what are essentially journal entries from your time doing that, but take me to the cemetery and what it was like for you being a historian, being down in the dirt in that hole and, you know, and seeing all of what was going on. What was that like for you after 40 years of working
at Oaklawn? Well, it was very moving, very emotional. You know, as soon as the archaeologists first saw the first outlines of the first two coffins side by side, I mean, that was, and all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, I can see them too. And I whispered something and they said, yeah. And they kept coming and two and two and two and two. And I mean, that was very complicated. I mean, it was of course thrilling having done this for so long a time, but you know, there's wistfulness and sadness too, because these are real people. This gets very real here, but you know, I mentioned it in the book, but the first thing I thought about were those survivors that I'd known who said, please go and do this. Please find out what happened to those people. And I thought, you know, somebody somewhere they're smiling, and I really thought of them, and they, you know, they've driven me to do this work as much as anything else.
What would it mean to you to be able to find another grave site? Whether it's because you spend a lot of time in the book talking about Neubach Park and the Canes and all that, and there seems to be high confidence there from the witnesses and stuff.
Yeah, so the Booker T. Washington Cemetery is a complicated, and I'll go to the Canes and Neubach in just a second, but that's a complicated situation. I believe there are not very many massacre victims buried there. I believe these were buried by Black people, by Black Tulsans, who, once they got out of these internment camps, they would find human remains near their property or on their property. That we know about this gentleman who had a truck and they took him out there. So this was the Black community burying their own, and there's every burying their own. And there's every reason to think that this was done with honor and respect and love. So I've never felt a burning need to exhume those remains. I think we can memorialize them. Neubach Park and the Canes, and they're really kind of one site. That's a whole other issue. And there's a lot of evidence I did not put in the book We have lots of people talking. My dad came back and he said he was forced to do this. Da da da. There's the Bob Patty photo. Remember the photo with the steam shovel? I think if we could find that, that would be that's the Holy Grail. And it's certainly I'm you know, as long as I'm kicking, I'm there to help, you know, make that happen.
Yeah. So your work is far from done.
No, I think I'm stuck now. I think this is a this is a permanent class that I'm never going to graduate from. I mean, I'm going to do other stuff too, but no, this isn't going to go away.
Are there other pieces to the story that you want to find, fix, correct?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, obviously, we want to find out how many people died. Yeah. You know, and we may never know, but having a better handle on that. There are mysteries and, after the first fighting sort of slowed down at the courthouse and whatnot, you know, we have these white men that are organizing other whites to get ready for this invasion. Who were those people? You know, I would love to know who they were. You know, there's conflicting evidence on whether the Klan was organized in Tulsa before the massacre or not. I err on the side of caution that I don't think they were, but were they? You know, I mean, that's something we don't know. You know, there's a lot of stuff, I mean, that we just still don't know. And there are, you know, but, you know, for years people would say, oh, it's all just rumor. We don't really know. You'll never know what happened. Well, that's not true. We know a lot about what happened. And we know what happened at a certain hour, at a certain corner, at a certain place. But there's more to come. And at this point, it'll probably be written records, maybe diaries and letters that people haven't seen. I think some demographers could do a lot of work with city directories and figure out how many people left. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff, but I spoke to a gentleman on the phone 2 weeks ago. His mother was grandmother was Cherokee Indian, and she was about 15 at the time of the massacre. And she told her grandson, who's now elderly, and I'm going to interview him next week, that when she was a little girl at the time of the massacre, she saw African-Americans hanging from trees with, you know, they had been lynched. Now, we've heard this story in the past, but I've never had the actual name of a specific person who saw this. Obviously, it's going to be secondhand information. We can't interview her, but I can find out where she was living at the time. Does that hook up with other stories? So it's just, you know, it's detective work, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that the pictures for the police department had in 73 that went disappeared, do you think those still exist?
You know, we tried to track that down. We found Betsy Warner found Sergeant Cotton's son. He had never seen him. We've had some looking around in the police evidence room, but Tim, I got to tell you, I'm trying to talk my way into that room. I want to go in there. I want to be able to look at the tops of the shelves and all that stuff and things like that. So I don't know, back in the early 70s, it was almost impossible to find any photographs of the massacre. And if you go to the University of Tulsa, McFarland Library Special Collections, they put stuff up that we've never seen before in the past few months. I mean, there's more stuff coming out. I think as we get a little further from the event, I think that there are going to be in white Tulsa families or in families who had family members living in time at the riot, that there'll be less embarrassment that they have these artifacts and that they realize they're important and we need to save them. So I'm hoping that happens. And plus we're in the digital world, so it's a lot easier to, you know, get copies of things.
Yeah, I'm convinced that the Tribune editorial is probably, there's a few copies of them stashed in scrapbooks somewhere, you know. And
like, I know. I'm the same way, you know.
I mean, it's got to be, you know, yeah. Just whether people know they're there or not, like, yeah. You know, just your family. It's 100 years ago.
Exactly.
What are the stories that we need to tell after the centennial? Because this a reoccurring theme in your book is we hit these big anniversaries and there's a lot of publicity and talk right. about it, and then it just goes away. And I don't think we're going to have that extreme because of Greenwood Rising and other right. things. But what are we supposed to do after the 100th commemoration?
Just well, keep I think we need to do a few things. I mean, obviously we need to be honest with our sons and daughters, you know, and tell how the past was. You know, Oklahoma school kids, they aren't snowflakes or robots. They can handle it. So, and obviously there's some very dark and disturbing parts, but, you know, the story of Greenwood is also a story of resilience, of people who refused to leave, who people said, no, this is my town. We built it and they rebuilt it again. So I think there's a lot of positivity that you can find about this. There were heroes and heroines during the massacres. Those stories can be told as well. But I think that we just need to be upfront and honest. The other thing is then, and I think this is a tragedy, and this is one of my other goals, is there has been so much of a focus on Black Wall Street that what has gotten lost were these remarkable 75 African-American veterans. I bet none of them knew Dick Rowland. I bet a single one of them did not know who this person was, but they were not about to have a racial brother be lynched in Tulsa. And not only did they risk their lives, some of them gave their lives. I mean, to me, there is American as the farmers at Concord Bridge. You fired the shot around the world. They aren't trying to break him out. They're just trying to make sure he gets a trial, even a rigged Jim Crow trial. I think that there should be a statue to them right in the center of downtown. The other issue is that the riot isn't this isn't just a Black story. This isn't a Greenwood story. This is a Tulsa story. You know, the story of the massacre involves, you know, as many, if not more, white people than it does African-Americans. And I think we need to bring the story downtown, and we need to bring it, you know, to neighborhoods across town.
What would it mean from a historical standpoint, and as a historian that you've researched a lot of things along the line, what would it mean for the city of Tulsa or the county or whatever to find people guilty or, you know, posthumously or whatever, find them responsible for what happened? Because right now we have the police chief went through a grand jury and was booted out of the force, and that was pretty much it.
Right.
So
I don't, you know, I've never thought apologies and stuff like that mean a lot. They may mean something to other people and for other reasons, but I don't see any reason to have some finding that claims that so-and-so, I mean, that's what historians do. I mean, that's their job, our job to do that anyway. I'm not sure where we get to. Look, there's, you know, I mean, it's possible. It's conceivable that there's a 115-year-old person somewhere who was 15 at the time of the massacre who created some horrible act of violence, but that person's never going to be brought to trial. There's no evidence. I mean, it's, you know, despite the fact there's no statute of limitation of murders, that day is long past. So I'm not sure what you can get out of that.
And what about reparations? Because that's something the commission back in 2000, 2001, right. they pushed for. And it's an ongoing discussion now in the lawsuit. So,
I like the term restitution, but I think we're stuck with reparations. Look, anyone who says that reparations isn't a complicated issue is lying to themselves. And, you know, and especially in Oklahoma, where you have a higher percentage of people with Native American ancestry, I think, than any other state. We have 23 native language spoken here, all of that. So you can't bring up the massacre and not also tend to think about what happened to African Americans. I started out being not particularly not in favor of reparations, but I was convinced otherwise in the 1990s by these survivors. I saw how much it meant to them, even a token payment. And to their families, and I understood it then. So I'm very much a supporter of reparations to the three massacre survivors and their descendants. It's not to say it's going to be easy to do, but look, the massacre is a finite event. You know, we can figure out who the people were, who the descendants are, figure out what can be done, And I think that we should do that. I know that's not a popular opinion in many parts of town, but you know, we had a great opportunity 20 years ago, even a $10,000 payment to the 130 or so survivors we had, but the state walked away from that and gave them gold-plated medals at all. You have to remember that these people were let down by the city, by the county, by the state, by the federal government. They were let down by the insurance companies that they had paid good faith money. They were just let down by everyone. Look, nobody alive today, none of us, not you, not me, none of us can live our grandparents' lives or our parents' lives. And we're not, we can't take credit for what they did, and we're not responsible for the bad things that they did. But we can only live our lives. But our institutions have carried on. And I think as a society, we owe something to these folks.
Why is it hard for people to just admit or accept their family's history that, you know, from before they even knew them 100 years ago? Like, because it seems like that's part of the problem, is that there are people who don't even want to talk about the past and their family tree and what could have been. Or,
well, I think that's normal. I mean, I certainly wrote about that a lot in Death in a Promised Land, and talking about how we construct a past that we live with. We don't look, neither you or I, anybody reading your piece, we don't want to dwell on the bad things that we've done. We just want to talk about the good stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's just normal, you know, human things. But I think that also it's important to remember, you know, the story of the massacre was actively suppressed in the white community for 50 years. You had whole generations of white kids growing up in Tulsa who'd never heard of this, you know, and it was also suppressed publicly in the African-American community as well, which I talk about. It's been difficult for families in these last 30 years to learn about this. This happened here. Are you serious? What, you know, and it's been hard for people to, you know, come to grips with that, you know, and, you know, right now and our country and Great Britain as well too, you know, it's coming to terms with slavery. What do we name buildings after? What do we not? This is, you know, we're undergoing, I have no idea where the process will come out, but we're undergoing, you know, all of this re-examination, you know, who are our heroes? Who are we as a people? You know, who do we want to emulate and who do we not want to? And those aren't easy things, you know.
Do you enjoy this period in time, though, as a historian, watching the country grapple with this?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I have a story from my own family. So on my Ellsworth family side, I have like great uncles or like twice removed, but two guys who won the Navy Cross, they were both admirals. One of them won the Medal of Honor. And that's a point of pride in our family. But he won the Medal of Honor in 1923 in Veracruz, when the United States Navy, you know, invaded Mexico and whatnot. And I've always been proud of it, but, you know, I have my sons who are 19 and learning a different view of, you know, Latin American history. And they're like a little less keen on it, but all of this is kind of normal. I mean, families, times change, how we look at the past changes. You know, maybe it turns out that grandma wasn't so bad after all. She was okay. But you can't define everyone forever on just one thing. I mean, everybody's complicated, you know.
Right. Have you been following the drama controversy surrounding House Bill 1775 here?
Well, I haven't read it. And that's the one thing I haven't done. It just seems it seems ridiculous to me. I mean, again, you know, and I mentioned this before, Oklahoma school children are not snowflakes.
Yeah.
They can handle hard stories. And we should teach the Trail of Tears. We should teach the Tulsa Race Massacre. I mean, I can't imagine what would these guys do with Pearl Harbor or 9/11? How would they write about it? You know, not all of our history is great and wonderful, and we're not always winning. And the only way our history is of value to us is if we are honest about it.
Yeah, that's something that I've been trying to understand, because I just read Facing the Mountain, the new book about Japanese Americans in World War II.
How was it?
It's really good. And It talks about how there was an internment camp at Fort Sill.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's
and
right.
So it jogged my memory that there have been Native Americans, Blacks, and yeah. Japanese Americans all interred in Oklahoma in camps.
Yeah, exactly.
Just in the last 100 years and change.
And so, German POWs as well, you know.
Right, but, yeah, that too. And so I find it all fascinating because I'm a big history buff and love reading it. And, you know, I can acknowledge that white people sucked for a lot of history, you know, for the time. I mean, right. They didn't like other races. They were trying to build, you know. And so I just find it fascinating that people can't or refuse to allow that to be taught.
Well, no, it's just crazy. And it's ridiculous is what it is. And I'm with you. I mean, I find all of these eras, you know, that, I mean, I read all sorts of history and lots of stuff and I'm fascinated by it, you know, and it, you know, the constant though, is it's human beings. We're, you know, humanity is constant. There's going to be heroes. There's going to be villains. We're going to mess up stuff. We're going to get some stuff right. You know, and the other thing is we have this tendency always to kind of look down on people in the past. Oh, how quaint they were. They didn't even have iPhones at Chancellorsville or something. And, you know, believe me, people are going to look down on us too and say, what were they thinking in 2021? But, you know, I'm with you on that. Absolutely. And Oklahoma history and Tulsa history is really fascinating.
Going back to it though, I was going to say the two stories from around the race massacre period that I'm really interested in, I hope someday we get resolution on, is Dick Rowland and Sarah Page, their story. You know, I heard again last week that Rowland descendants say that they had dinner at his family's house within the week of that happening. That's a story that's passed down, whether true or not, you know. There's the stories that they both got eloped and went off.
Oh, that's all a bunch of horse.
Right, that's what I figured. Right. But it's just like those stories float around. They seem to be growing now, the mythology of Dick Rowland. So.
Oh, sure, and other things are continue to grow and all of that kind of stuff, that the riot was pre-planned, that Dick wasn't in the courthouse, that McAuliffe had him and Sarah Page on a train to Kansas City where they lived openly as man and wife in the 1920s, you know, and stuff like that. You know, we've looked, you know, there's a question as to how many different names Dick Rowland had. The best I've ever heard again is that he went to the Pacific Northwest, which made sense to get the hell out of town. I had heard that he was maybe injured in an industrial accident during World War II, maybe working in a Liberty ship shipyard in Seattle or Portland. That made sense. But Sarah Page, she just vanished into thin air. I mean, you know, and, you know, there's nobody, you know, we've checked, you know, Social Security. I mean, we've done a lot of work and I'm sure there are plenty of other people looking. I hope we do find something.
The other thing I'm interested in is uncovering the Knights of Liberty. You touched on that in Death in the Promised Land. And then I know that Leroy Chapman did some work in Western Dowdy and them, but it just seems like that's another one of those stories that oddly fits in with the Watchmen theme, but in a different angle, you know, from a different swap, the vigilante masks, all that. And I'm fascinated by that story. And I want to know who all was involved. I know some people have been possibly ID'd, but that's one.
Oh, I think that's great. No, I'm with you all that. Let me know what you find out. I think that's great.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time, so I could.
Well, let me assure you that, and your readers, that I'm a Tulsan through and through. I insist whenever I come to town, I'm going to Claude's, getting a chicken fried steak at Nelson's, going out to the White River Fish Market, all of that stuff. But I'm always, I love my hometown, and I'm always happy to be back in it.
So I do want to ask, why stay away? I mean, you're making these, you're in Michigan, you're making these trips back and forth. Do you ever think maybe?
Well, we did. So my wife and I have 19-year-old twin sons. So we had to raise them and stuff like that. I love coming back. I mean, I was looking around at house prices and stuff. They're, you know, they're not bad, but I do. I mean, right now I will tell you this. I have right out my window. I'm in my office. That's like the 10th largest library in the world. I could hit it with a baseball. If they don't have it, they'll get it. I mean, this is a great place to get work done. So,
that's awesome.
And the winters suck. So you don't want to do anything. You might as well work anyway.
Tulsa Talks listeners, we love Tulsa and we know you do too. So does the Tulsa Regional Chamber. You might not realize it, but the Chamber is more than 100 years old, which more than makes it a Tulsa institution. They represent 2,000 member organizations and more than 175,000 area workers. As a business-driven leadership organization, their goal is to improve the quality of community life through the development of regional economic prosperity. What does that mean? It means their staff of 75 works hard every single day to attract, retain, and expand great businesses. They work to increase educational access and workforce skill levels. They advocate on behalf of their members at both the state and federal levels. They champion efforts to make our community more inviting and livable. And they promote our region as a vibrant tourist destination. To learn more about all that the Chamber does and to become a member, visit TulsaChamber.com.